Thanks. I really want to begin today by thanking Zoe Irvine for finding my research on the internet, partly because I was very deliberate in designing my study to make it a kind of repository for things experimental and Canadian in music online. So if you go to experimentalperformance.ca, you'll find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of links to all kinds of amazing artists. So this is a welcome opportunity to share some of my emerging ideas about the nature of experimental music performance in Canada, something I've been studying at 11 festivals across the country since 2003, and I'll be able to spend the next year writing about. Today, though, I'm going to focus specifically on work that I think is really embodied and social. So the embodied and social nature of digital, audio, and visual work by two teams of Canadian artists, Ian Burse and Laura Cavanaugh from Edmonton in the west of the country, and Dominic Skoltz and Herman Colgan from Montreal. Now, they're very different from one another, but both partnerships have something in common, and that is that they both employ digital, visual, and audio media on what I would characterize as a reciprocal basis. They use visual samples and soundscape recordings that make overt reference to the specificity of place by constantly reworking their materials to suit the particularities of a given performance context. The two works I'm going to discuss today, Removable Room by Ian Burse and Lauren Cavanaugh, and Silent Room by Skoltz Colgan, may both be considered immersive environments in which the very mutability of digital sound and image serves to highlight the embodied and social nature of digital performance. And it's really that argument that I want to make about performance itself being embodied and social. Now, the shared idea of room in both of these titles invites a consideration of space and place. Separating these terms is a useful idea that I borrow from Gassia Uzunian, who has theorized the role of the listener in sound art. Drawing on the work of Henri Lefebvre, Uzunian considers space to be a relatively general and sedentary term, sort of form of organization, a general and sedentary form of organization, while place focuses the particular, the situational, and the momentary, and is therefore always in flux and subject to change. Importantly, because space and place produce one another, there is an ongoing interplay between the particular and the general, the momentary and the lingering. Identity and place are understood to be mutually productive. Identities can be mapped out in terms of real and imagined distances, for example, to memories, experiences, other bodies, that are brought to bear in moment-to-moment situations that connect particular constellations of distances, bodies, and identities in place. Now, I think that Uzunian's formulation brilliantly captures the social dynamics of the rooms articulated by these works. The complex interplay of image and sound, both in the artist's conception and in the moment of performance and reception. So I want to first introduce you to the works and their creators, and then I'll offer some thoughts about how they utilize technology to perform the embodied social interaction that I characterize as send and receive. And I should say right off, although it's probably immediately obvious, that I come, of course, from a completely different orientation than our first two speakers today. So when I'm talking about listening and seeing and embodiment, I'm really speaking from the standpoint of a sort of fairly phenomenological standpoint, sort of, and I consider all of these things to be conditioned by culture. So I'm going to begin with Removable Room. Removable Room is one element within Ian Burse and Laura Cavanaugh's ongoing Instant Places, a project they began in 2003 and which they describe as an ongoing series of researches into place as a field of possibilities from which singularities emerge moment by moment. The artists explain that instant also points to the transformative power of the moment of performance, a time world of infinitely short duration that may serve as an opening to motion at right angles to history and clock time. During performance, we invite visitors to step with us into a space in which time is suspended. The immediacy of physical presence is vital. It is clear to us that the possible value of a performance lies in the consciousness of every person in the room. close quote. I really love that notion of the value of the performance lying in the consciousness of every single person in the room, because it points to something that is, in one sense, obvious, but in another way, not studied very much at all in this kind of work, which is reception. So one of the things that I've been doing is surveys of audiences, which work to a certain extent, but people don't really like to fill out paper when they're at a concert. So I find that if I take 6 or 8 people out for a beer after the performance, that they tell me amazing and fascinating things for as long as I'll keep buying about the way that they listen and watch music. So you might want to try that in your research. You know, beer is very effective. Yeah. Burse and Kavanaugh took Removable Room across Canada in 2006 and 2007, creating and installing it in several different cities. I experienced Removable Room at the 2007 Send and Receive Festival in Winnipeg. The artists arrived in Winnipeg a couple of weeks before the festival to begin their work, which initially involved walking the city, picking up odd bits of detritus that caught their attention, and documenting their walks with sound recordings and photos. As they explained to me in an interview, the performance begins at the moment they begin to interact with the environment. Kavanaugh told me that, quote, as soon as we arrive and start on a project, the attention and the focus that comes with that has a lot of the same kinds of intensities of marked off performance time. Also, we investigate. We walk around town, we take photos, we take sound samples, and it is inclusive of the performance aspect, because when you're out trying to get strange photos and recording things, people are very aware around you. You become a performer in a sense, because you are very attentive to where you are directing your thing, but there's also generally incidental audiences, we call them. People are aware that you're up to something, unquote. Burse and Kavanaugh use the artifacts they collect to transform the performance space, in this case, the stairway, entrance, and first room of Ace Art Gallery. Contact mics, small objects, a resonant coat rack, whoop, that's too far, and this tiny little room, it's basically a little plexiglass box that they built around an inflatable wading pool that they found in the space, and put sounding objects and contact mics inside of. All of these things performed along with constantly mutating digital images and sounds controlled in real time via max patches. And each of Burse and Kavanaugh have their own set of max patches, so they're improvising together, playing off of what the other is doing. But in this particular performance, their computers were not networked, although they have worked that way as well. So they're each working with their own kind of interpretation of the materials. Burse and Kavanaugh's personal experience of Winnipeg then was installed and created in this Removable Room, which they then presented during a 3-hour improvisational performance. So a very slow, very quiet, intimate little 3-hour performance. And I'm going to play you a clip from it, and I want you to take pay kind of special attention to the way that the performers behave in the space. Now, this is where the stuff that we've carefully put together is going to happen beautifully. Oh, no, wait a minute, it's just down here. Aha. Unfortunately, we've had quite a lot of problems with this Ready QuickTime video, and I don't want to spend too much time on this example. The thing that I want to suggest is perhaps somewhat available from the tiny little clip that you saw. What I want to suggest is that Burse and Kavanaugh's collaboration is founded on a kind of hybridity of human and machine interaction, but they don't consider this to be a neutral or a cold condition. Burse characterized the use of Max as providing lots of freedom to do whatever we want, while Kavanaugh said, I don't see technology as cold. It's warm, it's lovely, it's designed by human beings. It's part of us, you know. We're not disconnected. It's not this other thing over here. During the performance, Burse and Kavanaugh concentrated really closely on their tasks, avoiding eye contact with each other and with the audience, and moving with a very ritualistic kind of slowness. So it seems that they're very slow, non-matrixed kind of movements. You know, you move the mouse or you click something on the computer. We don't know what you're really doing, right? They could have been checking email the whole time, as everybody knows from laptop performance. But this is a very deliberate form of moving that they are doing in order to set the kind of tone for the performance. And again, sustaining this over 3 long hours. Burris, for example, told me that he refrained from taking off his sweater even when he became far too hot because he didn't want to distract the audience and disrupt the through line of the performance. Kavanaugh insists that digital performance is a strongly embodied experience. Speaking of a moment in the long performance when she ran out of ideas, she said, quote, "Sometimes your body will start to do something that's the right thing. That's the best. You're distracted. And then you just find that something's happening and is making a sound, and you can go with that." It's really quite a profound thing to say. She's saying, "I didn't think it up, I didn't do it, even though I'm not sitting with an instrument that, you know, you can see that when I move my arm, I produce a sound." Even though it seemed quite removed and abstracted for her, it's really something her body might start to use without her really thinking about it. The audience, in fact, had a great deal more freedom to enter and leave the space than the performers. Because this version of removable room was effectively in the entranceway to the gallery and served as an antechamber to the bar and reception areas where people could buy tickets for other festival events, people either flowed through the performance, brought chairs in and sat a while, or wandered around in the space. And several people took video during the performance, and they seemed to feel free to go right up to the performers. For Burris and Kavanaugh, this transient interaction is desirable, although they do also expect, and in this case got, I think, through their very ritualistic movements, quiet attention. Interestingly, the transience of both removable room as an installation, it's made entirely of found objects that are dismantled and discarded after the event, and of the audience, mirror Burris and Kavanaugh's own transience at the time that I interviewed them. In order to have maximum flexibility to develop projects at remote locations, they had given up their home base in Edmonton in favor of a nomadic lifestyle. And because they like to stay in the performance location for extended periods of time, a month or 6 weeks, they would often try to sublet an apartment or to house sit. Thus, their daily lives were also a process of creating removable rooms inside other people's living spaces. As Kavanaugh puts it, "Well, it's economic, and it's also related to the project. Because instant places and removable room are about space and time and moving around and the impermanence of things and transience of things. Once a removable room has been disassembled, all that remains is a kind of digital shadow, an archive of max patches, images, and audio files. The performative force of the work lies in the articulation of a specific social context that is entirely ephemeral." Now, while Burris and Kavanaugh's removable room is explicitly performative, improvisational, and ephemeral, Skoltz Colgan's silent room, which began life as a video project, is more archival, indexical, and multivocal. To read the short bio or anatomy on the Montreal duo Skoltz Colgan's website is to understand at once the interlacing of technological, biological, and political signifiers that pervade their work. Skoltz Colgan is a plurimedia work cell based in Montreal, comprising Dominic T. Skoltz and Herman W. Colgan. Rigorous and raucous creators, their artistic pursuits plumb the integral linkages between sound and image. Liberated by digital media, they simultaneously assume numerous positions, inhabiting a space between film, photography, audio art, and installation. Architects of worlds, Skoltz Colgan penetrate the ephemeral skin between solid matter and the unsubstantiated, the intimate and the objective. Their work conjures bewitched worlds that gestate betwixt accident and intent. And I like that they call their bio an anatomy. They're really invested in these biological metaphors. Now, it's important to note from the outset that Skoltz and Colgan create projects across a wide aesthetic range, from the extremely high-tech generative software used in their video, Epiderm, to improvisational performances, to the multivalence installation, DVD, book, and CD project called Silent Room. The artists describe Silent Room, which they began in the year 2000, as follows. "A cross-sected view of 16 people, 16 rooms, 16 lives. Silent Room is an X-ray vision of 16 interiors. In this film poem, the room is felt from the inside, as in an interior steeped in discontinuity, where unusual and poetic communications unfold wordlessly through a contamination of the senses. Rather than a storyline, there is a set of tableaux vivants, each crafted around a fixed idea, an impulse, a void, a hunger for an ideal. Now, like Burse and Kavanagh, Scholtz and Colgan fully integrate their art and lives. Trained as visual artists, they worked for about a decade in high-end television advertising, a legacy that may be seen in the extreme polish of their productions. The traumatic events of September 11th, 2001 caused them to make a decision to sever their ties to commercial work in order to concentrate solely on artistic projects, and they benefited from the economic security that their previous career had afforded them. Silent Room was the project they were brainstorming at the time of 9/11, and it has an eerie focus on the psychological state of intense isolation. So I want to take a close look at one of the rooms, room 274, Gustav. Hopefully I'll have better luck this time. I really hope so, because I love these guys' work and I was so excited about showing it to you. In Gustav, you'll see many of the techniques employed by Scholtz and Colgan. Handheld video footage, animated still photography. They set up several cameras on timers throughout the shoot. Good. So they're taking still photographs on timers at the same time as they're doing several different handheld cameras. Thank you. I want to just give you, why aren't you letting me go to the menu? Come on. Okay. All right. So I was going to show you the just the way the menu looks, just because it's beautiful, but I won't. It's all set up like an old apartment building in Montreal, and each of the rooms you choose from, like the mailing slot on the room, and their extra things are corridors. So they really take you in with soundscape recordings into the interior life of this imagined world. Now, as I was saying, in Gustave, we can see many of the techniques that they employ, these handheld video footage, animated still photography. About 10,000 photographs were created by multiple still cameras set on timers throughout the shoot. And the visual image seems always in motion, always restless. Well, it is, in fact, sound that provides the structural framework for the piece. For Skoltz-Colgan, sound is both an architectural and emotional, but above all, a cultural substance. They really talk about sound as a substance. Colgan: we build a kind of mood with different hardness or depth or softness of sound. Skoltz: it's not music. We say more like sound structure into space. Colgan: cultural sound, maybe we can say. Cultural sound. At the same time, we have the impulse to share something, to have a certain abstract harmony. We need to have both a cultural architecture, but with a human sense inside it. Skoltz: it's not intellectual, it's not mathematic, it's something we have to feel, always to serve the concept. If it doesn't go with the concept, we'll avoid using certain technology, even if it interests us. Now, this attitude towards sound helps to explain the intimate interaction of sound and imagery in their work. For Silent Room, they explain, the artist constructed digital frequency sensitive image generating software that instantaneously shadows the audio track, somewhat like a heartbeat monitor that shadows the frequencies of a heartbeat. But in this case, each frequency of sound can generate its image equivalent, right? So the music expresses a state of affect within the room and the internal realities of the characters. This is the film's narrative track. The soundtracks were in fact created first and played during the shooting in order to influence and inspire the actors who were asked to improvise on the scripts that they were given. But then the sounds of the soundtracks were also used to generate the choice of images at the editing stage. Most of the shooting took place in 2001 in an old textile warehouse in which Skoltz and Colgan would repeatedly construct and destroy the individual rooms. It is telling, in fact, that Silent Room was originally conceived as an installation where the videos would be projected in individual rooms that contained related artifacts, and it was presented this way in an Italian fortress at Transart in 2006. For Lucinda Catchlove, the installation version, quote, reveals the artist's intent to place the audience within the work, to engage us as participants, not merely observers. We are asked to interact, to become attached and implicit, and to enter into the silent room rather than to observe from a safe distance. Now, this concern with the audience was confirmed in my 2005 interview with Skoltz and Colgan after a showing of their film Epiderm at Montreal's MUTEC Festival. In Epiderm, a circular screen was fastened to a ceiling of a big round room with a gallery around it, and one watched Epiderm from a prone position on a yoga mat. Colgan talked about why they insisted on being present, standing up in the gallery, looking down on the audience, looking up at their film, at every screening. Quote, we prefer to be there to monitor the tech and to make sure that the sound and image are set up right for the room, but also to feel the feedback from the audience. It's subtle, but for us it's important. It's a kind of confrontation with the piece and with the audience. So even a straight-up film showing is performative. The duo makes a practice of continually modifying their works to suit different performative and presentation contexts so that they take on a fluid morphing quality. Interestingly, however, they also have an urge towards archiving that with Silent Room takes the form of a limited edition of 1,000 box set containing DVDs in both NTSC and PAL formats, a handsome catalog with photographs, essays, and notes, and two CDs, which bring a new and explicitly social dimension into the work. For Apartment Music, Scholz and Colgan commissioned 13 musicians, including people like Scanner, Steve Roden, and Sebastien Roux, among others, to create pieces using ambient sounds that they had recorded in their own living spaces. For chamber music, they commissioned 45-second recordings of performances by 9 musicians from various backgrounds and aesthetics. This is what I was playing at the beginning of the talk, including Lyle Ellis, Sawako, and Taylor Dupree, among others. And Scholz and Colgan then took those 45-second samples and remixed them to create virtual ensembles, duos and trios, etc. Similarly, the box set chronicles the many permutations of Silent Room as a performance of the rooms distributed across 5 screens, as an installation piece, and as a 10-minute distillation that flickers rapidly between the various rooms. The DVD of Silent Room not only allows us to plot our own route through the rooms, but takes us into the corridors between them, with footage of the shoot that contains intimate glimpses of the artists. For example, we watch them dancing an impromptu tango on one of the sets. Throughout, ambient soundscapes comprising brief fragments of speech, clanging doors, echoing footsteps, give us a sense of traversing the various rooms, immersing us in the acoustic space of the shoot. What I take from the Silent Room box is the meeting of the modernist concept of a contained, preserved, and limited edition artwork, the creation of an archive, with a postmodern notion of networks of affiliation, an index of possibilities. It is a specifically social approach that allows for the participation of numerous and diverse voices, and in doing so, invites us to reorder and reframe the materials. Now, both Silent Room and Removable Room highlight some particular properties of digital performance, and I want to take just a few minutes at the end here to think about these. I want to suggest, one, that digital performance breaks down hierarchies between the visual and the auditive. Two, that digital technology is by its nature embodied. And three, that embodied and non-hierarchical digital performance, therefore, offers a particularly heterogeneous form of social experience, one that allows for a plurality of simultaneous intentions and interpretations among performers and audience. The trope I'll use to describe this idea is send and receive. Now, as you all likely know, send and receive is a technical term used in telecommunications, and of course the name of this great digital media festival in Winnipeg. But my particular understanding of sending and receiving derives from a 1971 sonic meditation by Pauline Oliveros, who are just a great pioneer of improvised electronic music. If you don't know her work, you should immediately go and find out about it. She's been improvising with electronics since the 50s. Sonic meditations are collaborative exercises designed to foster deep listening perception. Sonic Meditation 3, Telepathic Improvisation, neatly illustrates the relationship between sonic and visual perception within the social space of performance. I'm going to quote directly from the score, which is just a bit of text. The musicians are seated amongst the audience and everybody participates. The instructions are simple. Play only long sustained tones. Play only when you are actually hearing a pitch or pitches mentally. Assume you are either sending or receiving. If you are sending, try to visualize the person to whom you are sending. If you are receiving, listen for the sound and visualize the sender. The quality and dynamics of the tones you play may be influenced by your feelings, emotional or body sensations, or even impressions of colors, which might come from the audience members. Continue until it seems time to stop. Now, a key factor in this feedback loop of sending and receiving is that audience members are also invited to influence the performance by mentally focusing on start-stop times, dynamics, tone quality, and emotional character. The clear implication in this kind of training is that music making is a profoundly social act in which the musical outcome is just a byproduct of social relations within a given space and time. More radically, musicking here is connected to visualization, as if sonic and visual signals are part of the same phenomenology. Oliveros's elision of auditory, visual, haptic, and emotional responses is in contrast to the traditional separation and hierarchy of the senses found in Western culture. And here I'm quoting from a philosopher, Wolfgang Welsch, who has written about the objectness of visual culture versus the immersiveness of audio culture. In his book, Undoing Aesthetics, Welsch argues that the Platonic worldview from which our visually dominant culture derives is based on the idea that we can identify and know that is, distance, objectify, and thereby control our world. By contrast, an auditive culture, he argues, would privilege the idea of immersion and foster a stronger sense of community, because in order to understand one another sonically, we have to both speak and listen, send and receive. But in Olivares's understanding, sonic and the visual and other sense stimuli are not set in opposition. Instead, the different senses influence and inform one another in a multimodal dynamic to articulate the inhabited space of performance. As Pedro Ravello has put, states, quote, the elaboration of links between the sensory modalities of hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, or touching defines the nature of our presence. Each of these modalities participates in a complex negotiation that inherently exposes contradictions and paradoxes. I like that bit. Sending and receiving need not elide these differences. The goal here is not unified understanding, but a more heterogeneous social ideal that encompasses a plurality of embodied experiences. Olivares's most recent work extends the idea of sending and receiving to the Internet 2 realm of Second Life, where all the performers and audience members meet in customized animated bodies in cyberspace in order to improvise together in real time across vast physical distances. Olivares is the character in the middle, or her Second Life avatar name is Freenoise. Contrary to the sense of dematerialization one might expect in this situation, performers report that they feel completely engaged, as if physically present in Second Life. Latency issues have been overcome to the degree that instantaneous, real-time improvisation is possible, and a genuine sense of community may be created. So not only are visual and aural perception interrelated in the performative act of sending and receiving, but embodiment, as Olivares demonstrates, is itself deeply implicated in technology. The technology theorist N. Catherine Hales resists the idea that bodies have become obsolete in the context of the digital age. Hales posits, quote, a certain kind of postmodern subjectivity that has emerged from theories of the discursive construction of bodies and is constituted by the crossing of the materiality of informatics with the immateriality of information. By informatics, Hales means the material, technological, economic, and social structures that make the information age possible. Now, it's easy to imagine this crossing of informatics and information in the animated world of Olivares' Second Life performances. For example, I've had the experience of being in the physical audience watching Olivares and other musicians and dancers on stage, in addition to watching a screen on which their live improvised cyber performance with other musicians in a different continent was unfolding. Very hard to get your head around that. Hales insists that digital technology may absorb the body as a general concept, but embodiment as particular experience nevertheless persists. She writes that embodiment is inherently performative, subject to individual enactments, and therefore is always to some extent improvisational. Whereas the body can disappear into information with scarcely a murmur of protest, embodiment cannot, for it is tied to the circumstances of the occasion and the person. Now, a focus on embodiment means a focus on context and environment, an inversion of Cartesian logic. Hales states that whereas the causal thinking that Descartes admired in geometry and sought to emulate in philosophy erases context by abstracting experience into generalized patterns, embodiment creates context by forging connections between instantiated action and environmental conditions. Marking a turn from foundation to flux, embodiment redefines the role and importance of context to human cognition. Embodiment creates context because of its articulation of space and place, the bringing together of instantiated action, here artists' sonic and visual expressions, and audience members' varied ways of receiving them, with environmental conditions, for example, a particular room and transmission technologies. So just to briefly return to the art of Burson-Kavanagh and Skoltz-Holgen, I think that both removable room and silent room serve to highlight a particular potential of performative digital media, of sending and receiving. Through their complex interplay of space and place, these works act as sites of an embodied and heterogeneous sociality that has the potential to dissolve hierarchies of media, audio and visual, experience, performance, and reception, and perhaps even materiality of human and technology. Thanks.